The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the one announcement I want to make before I start the talk is that today's the last day then that we're going to do the fundraising for Save the Children for their work with the refugees from the war in Ukraine. And it's kind of not very nice that so far we've raised directly $73,000, which is a lot of money for us and the community. And some people have donated, been inspired by this and donated directly to Save the Children rather than through us for their own reasons. So I think it's kind of powerful when a community comes together and does something like this, and you see the aggregate, you see the coming together of shared goodwill, intentions, desires to make a difference. So thank you, all those of you who've contributed, and I think the treasurer will kind of close down everything tonight and send Save the Children a check. So the topic for today's talk, it can seem like some people will roll their eyes maybe when I gave the title, but hopefully by the end your eyes will have settled down. And that is meditating for peace. Meditating for peace. So many people for centuries have associated meditation in the Buddhist context with the goal of liberation, often for personal liberation. One of the remarkable things is that there can be other motivations for doing the same practice. In other words, the same practice, doing the same thing, can function for different purposes, even purposes you didn't intend. And one of the purposes of meditation is to contribute to a peaceful world. And it turns out that if you dedicate your practice to liberation and dedicate it to your practice, to your meditation practice, to supporting a peaceful world, you pretty much do the same practice. It's not that different, except for the motivation. But it makes a difference, the motivation you do it. And it's also possible that dedication for liberation can remain, and it can join with the motivation to contribute to a peaceful world. And the benefit of that is there might give a wonderful and healthy and stress-free, perhaps, sense of urgency for the meditation practice. Like the practice is important, it's valuable. It gives it like, and right now, with the war in the Ukraine, the wars in Yemen and Eritrea, different places in the world, Myanmar, all kinds of horrible things the world's doing. But for many of us, I think what's happening in Ukraine is so horrific and so dramatic, and seeing it so clearly with the images and everything, that, it's really something that, and also it represents for many people a real turning point in human history and our situation here. Things are changing in such a big way, it's going to affect the whole globe in a way that some of the other wars may don't affect it so dramatically, the whole globe. And so, if we're meditating anyway, meditate for peace. And how is it that meditating can contribute to peace in the wider world? That's the topic for today. And so one of the things is that what we learn, how we're transformed, and what we learn about ourselves changes us into a person who can then approach the conflicts in the world, the suffering of the world, in a more useful way. The very things we learn about being present for ourselves and plumbing to the depths of ourselves in meditation transforms us so that we can bring some of the same benefits into the world. So there's a number of things that meditation can do, or it's about in our tradition. One is to be a witness for what is true. The second is to heal what needs to be healed. The third is to liberate what can be liberated. And the fourth is to cultivate the best in us, the best qualities within us, the best of our character. And those four things are being cultivated when we meditate. And it's powerful to do this. As we do it for ourselves and learn what it means to do it for ourselves, those very same things can be offered in how we attend to a present for the world. We can be a witness for the world, witness of what's true. We can be a healer for what needs to be healed. We can be help liberate what needs to be liberated. And we can cultivate the best qualities that are needed for this world. So how does this work for meditation? And a huge part of what mindfulness is being honest. But I like the expression of being a witness to what is true, because it has two qualities. First is that we're trying to see what's really true here for ourselves, in ourselves. And sometimes what's true about ourselves is not exemplary. Sometimes it's not even the things we want to share with other people because we feel embarrassed or worse. Sometimes what's true for ourselves is something we don't even want to admit for ourselves. Or we have trouble understanding it or seeing it, the truth of it, because we don't know how to be a witness. So the other aspects of being a witness for the truth is witnessing. And one of the things we're doing in this practice is learning to be a clear, calm, open, available witness to what's there. To be a witness before we're a judger. To be a witness before we're a fixer. To be a witness before we're an escaper, getting away from it all. That we're cultivating the ability to be present and witness even the most difficult things a human needs to see sometimes. And we're doing that with ourselves. Now, some of you might be saints. And so maybe that's what you get to witness. But for most people, there are parts of ourselves that are not necessarily what we're most proud of, and difficult and challenging. And so part of meditation is to learn to be a witness to what is hard for us to witness. To witness how we're attached. To witness how we're afraid. To witness how we have caught in the grip of desires or preferences, judgments. How we operate with hostility. We're all saints. Beautiful, calm, and peaceful until the unexpected happens. And then it triggers all kinds of frustrations and angers and things. These poor computers they've been recipients of so much frustration and anger. Some people like want to throw them across the room, you know. But to learn to stay calm and work with it. And so to see what's going on and be a witness in ourselves, which means to witness all those things, the anger, the frustration, the desires, the fears, the judgments, and to be able to witness it in a way that we're not automatically approving it, not automatically participating in it. We're kind of stepping back and being the witness of it. It's a powerful thing to witness. And there's something healing about witnessing. To say, could be honestly see, make space in room. Oh, this is what's happening. And for some people, what we're witnessing is the inner wars. Some people live with all kinds of conflict within themselves. Some people live with sides of themselves, parts of themselves, that they don't want to admit, don't want to accept. They want to push away. They want to deny. They're angry at hostile even towards part of who they are. And don't even want to talk to those parts or relate to them. Maybe because we grew up in thinking we're always supposed to be strong, and so there's parts of us that are weak. Maybe it's because parts of ourselves is afraid, and we don't want to accept the part that's afraid and tender and vulnerable. Maybe there's parts of ourselves that we want to deny, or we feel like is wrong, or maybe there's parts of ourselves that is from which we've been hurt in the past, and we don't want to ever look at that again. We don't want to admit that we're hurt. And so sometimes there's these inner wars, two sides of a person even. And that, so to be a witness to that war, to be a witness to that conflict. Sometimes it's not so much like we're split, but sometimes it's just like, we're horrified or upset or embarrassed by parts of who we are. In this mindfulness practice, we're trying to show up to be a witness and be honest. Oh, this is the truth. There's inner conflict. There's inner challenge of who I am. I'm not kind and calm and reflective about what's happening for me. I'm actually trying to avoid it, or trying to push it away, or repress it, or deny it. And it's certainly not something I would admit to other people. So we sit in meditation to be a witness, the good, the bad, and the ugly, to really see. And it can be hard to accept the possibility of just witnessing, because we're supposed to fix, we're supposed to be different. If we just witness it, it's like that means I have to admit it, or I'm making room for what shouldn't be. But slowly we're learning to discover to trust that it's actually quite powerful and useful to be a witness, to see the truth, witness to the truth. Oh, this is what's happening. And learn to overcome or to recognize all the ways in which we avoid the truth, so that we can become a witness of the truth. Things don't get in the way. And then there's healing what needs to be healed. So sometimes these divides within us, it's not so much a matter of making what we don't like about ourselves to go away, but when there's a war, or a divide, or a split within us, is to heal that. Bring together, bring into our hearts in a deep way the things about ourselves that are difficult and challenging, to hold it kindly, to open to it. The heart knows what to do. The inner life knows how to unfold and heal itself if we create the conditions for it to heal. Or we bring the conditions that help it heal. We bring kindness and compassion and love. We bring honesty. Honesty is powerful. Just the more truth, and really, really say it. We bring making amends. Sometimes we have to kind of do something. Only by doing, not just in meditation, sometimes by doing, does something have a chance to be healed. Maybe we have to apologize to people. Maybe we need to engage in the world in a way that informs the heart that we're under new management. So something can begin to relax and to heal. Sometimes there has to be expressions of gratitude for what was. There's a beautiful, powerful, for me, story. I've told this many times now. I'd like to tell it again. When I was growing up in Los Angeles, we get the Los Angeles Times, and periodically in the 1960s there would be this little article in the newspaper about Japanese soldiers from World War II who were still fighting World War II in the 1960s because they had been sent into the jungles of the Philippines by their commanders to be kind of guerrilla fighters or something. And so they were told to stay in there and fight the war until we come and get you. the war ended, but no one came to get them. And so they continued living there dutifully, and they were stealing chickens from local farmers. Somehow they managed to make do for, I think the last one was like 25 years later. So then they were found and brought back to Japan. The story that I've been told about how they were brought back to Japan, that's what's so significant, is that the Japanese would bring out some very senior military officer still alive from World War II who'd put on his best uniform and maybe the samurai sword, symbolic, and would walk through the jungle, the Japanese calling out for the soldier to come out. When the soldier came out, the first thing that the officer would do was to do this deep bows that they do in Japan and offer gratitude. Thank you for your service to the mother country. I'm here to bring you back. They put him on they go together on a boat. They would go back to Japan. Just before the soldier was going to get off the boat to step onto Japanese soil, the officer would say again, thank you so much for your great service to the country. And then maybe with a lower voice would say, and by the way, the war is over. For some of us, the wars we're fighting are long over. They've continued from childhood. And what's significant about this story is the gratitude. Sometimes the wars we've been fighting, the struggles we're against, and the ways we're fighting against ourselves even, were ways to try to manage to survive in horrific issues, situations growing up. And we survived. We're here. And maybe that was needed. That's how we've managed. Maybe there would have been better ways to do it. But as a child, you didn't know what it was. And this kind of kept you alive. And so this idea that we have these so-called, unfortunate, unhealthy sides of ourselves that we don't like or is difficult or embarrassing, who knows why they're there? Maybe they were an attempt to try to take care of ourselves at some point. Probably it was. So maybe before it can be let go or put to rest, to express gratitude, thank you. And once the thank you has happened, imagine that. Thanking your fear, or thanking your greed, or thanking your anger. What a different relationship. Appreciating that this was an attempt to try to take care of yourself. And then reminding yourself, oh, by the way, the war is over. It's okay. So that's an example of healing. And the connection between truth and healing is quite important. In California now, there's a council, state created a council called the Truth and Healing Council. I think in the last few months, that it's going to go for 2 years, 2 or 3 years. Just similar, I think, to what the Truth and Reconciliation Council in South Africa did, but with the indigenous people of California, the Native Americans. There's never been a time when the state, with its important role, that is going to really take in the truth of what happened to the Native Americans in the state, which was horrific. It was kind of genocide. And to really hear it, take it in, and then heal. It's interesting that the word is not reconciliation, but healing. I'm not sure why they chose that, but it's maybe does something different. And so here, so there's now meetings. You can go to those meetings. They're online. And as a state, kind of gathering information, hearing the truth, in preparation for some kind of healing. So as we learn to be a witness for the truth in ourselves, then there can be healing in ourselves. As we learn to be a witness for ourselves, we can learn to be a witness for what goes on in the world. If we can be a witness of what goes on in the world, we can maybe contribute to the healing of the world We need people to be witnesses of it. So, you know, as some of us are figuring out how much to learn about what goes on in Ukraine, what to look at and what to take in, part of what we're doing is being a witness for it. It's important that the world has witnesses for this, that we don't deny it or don't overlook it or don't go asleep. It's very important for people to know the truth of it, to bear witness. Because without that, there can't be any healing. There's not going to be any healing. There's not going to be any movement in a good direction at some point. How much can we bear being a witness? How do we bear witness? And so the best qualities of who we are summoned in that witnessing. We don't get despair. We don't despair. We don't get angry. We don't get, you know, all these other things that might get in the way of a deeper, fuller, productive healing witnessing. I'd like to suggest that that's one of the things we're learning through meditation as we witness ourselves. How do we witness the truth of ourselves so that we don't succumb to more anger, more conflict, more fear, more hostility, all these things, or more overwhelm? And so we're developing this muscle of being a witness in ourselves. We're learning about how what goes on inside of us and what gets in the way. And so we're ready when what happens in the world happens, that we can be a witness. I think it's so important. And then to liberate what needs to be liberated. So we learned how to do that in ourselves. We learn where we're holding on tight, where we're attached, where we cling, where we resist in some deep way, where the heart is contracted or is made dense and small. And we learn to open it. We learn to free it. We learn to let go in some deep, full way. So there's breathing room for this heart of ours, breathing room for the mind. So there's space for the good qualities inside of us to flow. Part of the paradox is that, I don't know if it's a paradox, or the more we are attached, the less space there is for the best qualities in us to grow and develop. The more we've let go of attachment, the more space there is, more breathing room for the best qualities we have inside to grow. So to liberate, to learn to be truthful, to recognize not just what wants to be healed, but a deeper place is to recognize where liberation is, to recognize where we're stuck. And some of the difficult things to see, because some of the most deep-seated attachments we have are not seen on the surface mind, the surface of our life. That's one of the functions of meditation, is to really get quiet enough to see the depth of what's happening. That's overshadowed by, you know, a lot of discursive thought and ideas and reactivity. As we learn in ourselves more and more what liberation is, then we can appreciate that other people have that capacity too. And in some ways it'll break your heart even more than seeing war, is to see how this wonderful, profound capacity of the human heart gets squashed by war, gets lost in the pain and the fear. And it could go on for generations, the effect of war. Now, there can be some healing, but for people to discover the best possible form of happiness and well-being that can only happen when we're free of our attachments, war can really kind of make that hard and difficult. To be a witness, not only for what's difficult in the world, but to be a witness for the possibility for people to be happy, the possibility to let what's beautiful and best in them to come forth, to be a witness for the capacity of people to start becoming free, both politically and, you know, societally, but also free in their hearts. I think something in people's hearts, maybe by osmosis or subconsciously, resonates when there's people who know something about liberation. And they can be a witness to that possibility, capacity in our world. So, to liberate what needs to be liberated, in a place like Ukraine, there's not going to be any deep, or very little deep, liberation of the heart without supporting this country to become liberated from the oppression of Russia. They're losing their freedom there. And so I think that the dedication of coming out of meditation is to appreciate that, yes, we have to kind of support these people to become free. And where all the freedom is, you know, is it only with the Russians, but is there other places? But to appreciate liberation. And then the fourth part of meditation is to let the best qualities of who we are come forth, to grow and cultivate and expand. It's remarkable what our hearts are capable of. Love of all forms. What a great world it would be if we let all the different flavors, 32 flavors of love, grow in us. Kindness, goodwill, care, compassion, friendliness, appreciation, taking delight in other people, respect. You know, there's all these words that I associate with love. And to let those grow and develop. Generosity, wisdom, peace, non-reactivity. As we learn this for ourselves, and let this grow in ourselves, then we become a carrier of that into the world. And we become a, you know, it's kind of like contagious. And whether you have a mask on or not, it's contagious. And so to be able to come into the world oriented around these good qualities, if we don't do that, then there's very little hope for the world. We need people who demonstrating the possibility of meeting even the most horrific things free of hostility, free of the greed of self-protections. I'll just take care of myself and not other people. But to come with this beautiful capacity for love and care and support for others. To appreciate that maybe we live in this world in mutuality. Cooperatively. The world is a cooperative place. Earth, nature, societies are cooperative enterprises. And so how do we live cooperatively? How do we let the whole cooperative function well and completely? What do we contribute? How do we support those of us who can the welfare and happiness of others? So this is my attempt to say that maybe it's healthy for to have a sense of appropriate urgency around doing. If you're meditating already, and anyway, that's what we do. Please continue, but maybe you can add important, rich, valuable motivation and understanding. That the meditation is you're not just doing it for yourself, but that at the same time as you're doing this deep practice for liberation for yourself maybe, you can also do it for the welfare and happiness of the world, to support this world that's so challenged. And there's an urgency to do that. not to put you, not for you to hurry through your meditation, because it's an urgency that way, but rather not a hurry, but rather to give a kind of wonderful ballast or wonderful seriousness, wonderful weight to the practice, so that you're like, oh, I'm going to do this. This is important. And so you don't so easily wander off into daydreams or wander off into, you know, doing Sudoku problems in your head, maybe. But you kind of, you're really there with some gravitas, some sense of, this is important, this is where, and to meditate for the world. So in this way, we can meditate for peace. So we have a wonderful practice. I hope that it will serve all of us to be able to contribute to the welfare of this world that needs a lot of help. Let's be the helpers for it all. Let's help, not hinder what this world needs. So thank you very much. And you know, the usual format has been to end at, in the old days, 10:45, and the YouTube time ended right around now, so 10:30. So, but if some of you here, and I can try to look at the chat, if some of you would like to ask any questions or make any comments, you're welcome to do it. It's kind of nice to hear from the community now that we're together, and so you, and if you could say your name when you start, then we could also get a sense, richer sense of ourselves. Your voice will go on YouTube unless you, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know it was going to be on YouTube, but anyway, my question. I'm Yolana. And my question is, when you witness the fear or the worry, what happened to the emotions? I mean, I have a lot of emotions.
Uh-huh.
You just shut them down?
No.
While witnessing, you know, the fear?
You witness them. You make room for them. You don't act on them. You don't pick them up and think about them and reinforce them. But that's where learning to be a witness is, you want to see it all. It's almost like you can step back and not live in the emotions, not live in the thoughts, but you almost like step back and see, oh, this is, these are emotions. Look at this. This is chaotic. This is, and learn that art of stepping back. So the seeing, the witnessing is not entangled in what we see.
So what you're saying is, witness the emotions too. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And one of the ways of understanding it with fear is to, when we witness fear, we're helping the fear feel safe. Because fear is kind of, if we're attacking fear, trying to get rid of it, and have some idea it shouldn't be there, and I should be better, I've been meditating for years, I shouldn't, not supposed to have fear, and this is, I'm an embarrassment to the Buddhist world. Then, you know, the poor fear is just going to feel terrible. And what we're trying to do is to help, just to witness it, oh, it's fear, in a way that the fear finally feels safe. Okay, it can just be there, it's not, it, fear doesn't have to be afraid. Okay, great. Thank you. Yes?
Hi, I have a question exactly about witnessing. Certain brains, I would say, certain experiences, have created a fear-ridden brain.
What?
A fear-dominated brain.
Yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And in the witnessing, because sometimes a fear-dominated brain will continue to bring up again and again really fearful experiences, right? And in the witnessing of that, I have a fear that the neurology of the fear, and the same would be with anger, that ultimately the neurology of witnessing and experiencing something that's coming up so frequently, that it will amplify.
Yeah.
And I, you know, there I have a certain concern about that. You know, there are certain brains that are so prone to that.
Yeah.
So, and I'm just wondering, mindfulness in that kind of context. Yeah.
So one of the core principles of the Dharma is to be mindful of the effect, the consequence of what we do. So if the consequence of being in mindfulness, bringing mindfulness or bringing witnessing to our fear continually produces more fear, then it's not helpful. And then but it's useful to know that. So part of the benefit of mindfulness then is to see, oh, this is what happens when I am present for fear. I get more afraid, I shut down, this stuff kind of happens. So once you see that's happening, then you have the information you need, which tells you, I need to find a different way. And so in meditation, some people switch their meditation practice to do loving kindness or compassion meditation. Some people find it useful to do a very, emphasize a lot of body meditation, just rest in their body rather than in the emotion, and find a neutral place in the body where they can kind of stay with and be with. Some people find that they need to do something very different. Sometimes we have a wealth of what's called trauma therapy now, and so, which is working with this very issue, that it's too hard for some people to just be present for their own fear and hurt and pain. And so there's all these techniques or ways of working with it indirectly or not indirectly, but wisely, that is not really the place, not really the strength of Buddhism. Buddhism historically helps people, a lot of people work through trauma, but more than just maybe a lot of other things. But sometimes we need extra help, extra support, and so specialists who know about it, and to find out how to work through it, and all that is, and nowadays there's a lot of things to try besides meditation when the repeated contact with fear produces panic or more fear or shutting down.
Yeah, thank you.
And also sometimes one-on-one conversations with a meditation teacher can sometimes show how mindfulness or how, you know, what you can do that's different, how to practice mindfulness differently so it can be helpful. So, you know, so it's all these things are possible. But does that answer your question?
Yes, my intention was to bring up this to the light in today's talk.
Uh-huh,
yeah,
uh-huh.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Molly. I have found that people are so vocal about their opinions in the media and so strong-willed that they almost make it sound like it's factual. So sometimes I feel that it's a struggle not to be judgmental.
It might help to distinguish being judgmental from being evaluative. Or judgmental versus recognition. So it's possible to recognize what someone's doing or suspect what someone's doing, and it might be evaluative where you say, well, you know, I don't think this is a healthy thing for that person or for all of us. And that doesn't have to be hostile or devalue the person, or push someone away. And so sometimes one of the reasons why the word judgment is so powerful is that it's not a simple evaluation of the situation. It often comes with this hostility itself, this pushing away or shutting down or creating a strong sense of other. They're wrong as a person. So if you stop being judgmental, some people think that if they stop being judgmental, they're not supposed to be evaluative anymore. And so that just makes the whole thing more harder. So you might see if you can relax a little bit and switch the orientation of what you're doing to being evaluative, to recognize and evaluate what's going on, and see if that takes the sting out of it. So behind you.
Hi, my name is Grace. I just want to say that I really appreciate...
Can you turn it louder, please? Because my hearing...
Turn it back on.
Oh, okay. My name is Grace. Uh-huh. I just want to say that I really appreciate how you point out it's though starting with end, trying to work on internal healing, and that's how we can relate to things differently.
Nice.
So that's really, really eye-opening and profound for me. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, one of the motivations I have for being a Buddhist teacher is to contribute to a better world. But I have a strong belief that this practice does that.
Hi, I'm Gaurav. Thanks for the talk and meditation. One of the things that came up in mind about witnessing was, like, I have this mistrust of the media. And that's how I witness what's going on in the world. So there was a conflict there, like, how do I witness when media has an incentive to manipulate my emotions and stuff?
Yeah, this is a really important question. So how do we become wise consumers of the news? So I think one of them is to ask yourself, the news that you are listening to, can you find out what their bias is and recognize? Sometimes it's very clear. And then when you're reading it or looking at it, you remember that. And you say, like, oh, I should be careful here to how they're doing it. The other is to look for sources that maybe don't express as obviously bias. They're maybe more neutral. There's a website called, I think it's called All Sides, maybe allsides.com. Maybe, or outside something, and it's they'll have lined up three columns, one newspaper that's has news from the right, political right, another column on the other side has political left, and then the middle is some news that they evaluate as more middle, and sometimes it's fascinating to read news from all three. Because then you get a sense of the range, and it's clear how people are biased if you see it that way. Another thing that I like to do is, I learned this many years ago when I was living at the monastery in the 1980s, that we were deep in the mountains, and the newspaper would come in maybe once a week or something. So almost always the news was old in the newspaper. And I learned, it was really eye-opening to see when I was reading news that was 2, 3, 4 days old, that my body, my mind, my heart, would not get excited, would not get alarmed the way it did when I thought the news was fresh. And so you might try reading the news late, you know. Or read, you know, weekly magazines or monthly magazines that talk about the same thing. You know, you don't have to be right on top current by the day. And maybe just read the headlines currently, but to go deeper, maybe you could do it something that's, you know, a little bit older. Just because then you also have, you yourself will be able to pick up more, but not be as reactive to the bias or what goes on. And then a neutral source that I've enjoyed doing sometimes is sometimes I go on Wikipedia and read about a particular news event in Wikipedia, and it's kind of like an encyclopedic entry. And I'm sure it's biased there too, but it doesn't have the charge. Not written with the kind of the charge of popular news, where they're trying to keep your attention and really kind of keeping you there with the news. And the writing is a different style. It's like an encyclopedic. Okay. It's kind of matter of fact, and it tends to be broader and simpler. And so I find that sometimes very helpful for me to go check there. So does this give you some ideas? It's a really important topic you bring up. So it's becoming, being wise in how we relate to the news is an important part of this. And so one of the things to do in terms of being a witness is to be a witness of how your reaction is to the news. And that's really important. Can the best of you come out rather than the worst in you when you read the news? Okay, well, thank you and very much. And may you be a peacemaker within and without.